Hello and welcome to this special discussing episode where we are going to have a discussion about, well, theatres. I was going to say theatres, playhouses, playing spaces, spaces where some kind of theatrical or ludic activity occur, what we know about them and, or more importantly, what has changed in our idea about various playing spaces based on the actual physical spaces themselves. For many, many years, so much was said and written based on inferred evidence from plays and accounts. But over the last few decades, an awful lot of digging has occurred. And my guest will hopefully be able to tell us a little bit more about that, about some of the processes of, and basically what has changed from our earlier understanding to the idea of where we think things are going now, based on all the actual good, solid evidence, or occasionally very damaged evidence based on what later building work has done to things. So my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
that's a great question to start with. Hi Rob, my name's Heather Knight. I'm an archaeologist, I work for MOLA, and I've had the real pleasure of leading the excavations on three playhouse sites. That was the Curtain, the Theatre and the Boar's Head.
So give us a little overview of how people viewed theatres and theatre spaces in the past, you know, that vague general idea of the past.
Well, the first playhouse we looked at archaeologically was the Rose. That was back in the late 1980s. And obviously before that, playhouses were in the realm of the historians' research. And they did a fairly good job, you know. I mean, by the beginning of the 20th century, they'd pretty much mapped fairly accurately playhouse locations across London, around London. I mean, they were struggling. They didn't have many contemporary images to work with. Most of the images they have are of those playhouses on Bankside. So they had sort of developed by the beginning of the 20th century a very kind of easy narrative, I suppose, that all proper playhouses are big and round. So they start off sort of big and round, and the pinnacle of playhouseness is the big round globe in 1600. That's fine. And then archaeologists started, you know, getting involved back in the 80s. So the first playhouse we looked at was the Rose, and then we also dug a small part of the globe. And then in about 2000, we dug the Hope, three playhouses on Bankside, all big and round. So that really didn't kind of change that narrative that proper playhouses were big and round. And then I dug the site of the Theatre in 2008. Again, pretty big and round, a bit like the Rose. But things did change when we dug the site of the Curtain. And then all of a sudden we had a square, well, rectangular building that Professor Holger Simon described at the time as a game-changing moment, and it has been a game-changer.
Let's go back before we go to squareness of things. I'm fascinated about actually just the nature of the shape of spaces. but going back to that first excavation of the Rose, which obviously you weren't actually involved in.
I was an archaeologist working in London at the time, but not in that part of London. Now I was working out west, so I was looking at it jealously from afar.
Because it's interesting there with the they were able to sort of connect archaeology with the accounts they had of, because it's a site that gets renovated and during its lifetime, and we're able to resituate or sort of confirm ideas about it. So it's that again, going back to that idea that connecting the dots was where some of that early archaeology was going.
I mean the Rose is, you know, it starts off being a, you know, 14-sided polygonal structure, sort of 22 metres across. And then in the sort of 1590s, it then changes shape and becomes more horseshoe-shaped. So the sort of the business end becomes squarer. So, yeah, and that kind of ties back in with what, you know, the Henslow's diary and, you know, money being spent on the building and things. So, yeah, those two things kind of did join up and support each other.
I think many people will know about the globe, and of course there is a reconstruction version. But the Hope, I imagine some listeners may not actually know so well as a theatre itself. It's a later theatre than many of the others, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, I think it's also, what, 1613-ish? Mm. So I might have got that one wrong. But yeah, no, and it's quite interesting because it's built as a sort of dual purpose venue for both, you know, playing and bear baiting or animal baiting. So, and I don't know, it's sort of archaeologically, it was quite tricky to extract what was playhouse from later development on the site. It ends up being glassworks and very other things, and it was only a small amount of it dug. But the small part that was identifiable as the Hope did kind of conform to this, you know, these polygonal 14, 16-sided structures.
And then, as I say, you dig up the curtain and you find that the curtain is a very, very different space.
Very different space. Yeah. It was like, okay, let's think. And I actually started looking at playhouses in other parts of Europe because we kind of knew we had the playhouse because of the material culture associated with it. Because by that point, we had dug, as you say, the Rose, the Globe, the Hope, the Theatre. We were building up what it was referred to as the depositional signature of a playhouse, the things you'd expect to find in a place of commercial entertainment. Things like beer mugs and the tops to money pots, for instance, in you know, significant quantities. So we were finding the material culture of a playhouse within a building that was rectangular. So it was like, well, the finds are telling me this is a playhouse. So what kind of playhouse could it be? And I started looking at initially the playhouse in Gdansk, which is obviously a square rectangular building. And then I was looking at the playhouse in Almagro in Spain. And I just looked at it and I went, wow. I mean, that's still standing, still used as a playhouse. And I was looking at it and going, wow, that is like looking at the curtain. It's got, you know, those kind of rooms to the side of the stage. It's got foundations for, you know, at the curtain, we've got foundations for a very kind of wide stage, 14 meters or so, which is like the stage at the Almagro. And there's between, from the side stage rooms, there's doorways leading down under the stage to create a passage so you can cross the stage out of view. And that's exactly what was happening in that playhouse in Spain. And that's what the archaeology was doing on the site of the curtain.
Yeah, in that sense, if you dug it up first before the Rose and the Globe, etc., would you have recognised it
for what it was? Probably not, because we wouldn't have had that depositional signature. Hmm. We wouldn't have understood that material culture that you find associated with the playhouse, because we wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have had the information from the other sites. So, would I have recognised it? Probably not. Maybe we needed to practice on a few first before we ventured into the curtain.
And how much of the site was actually was extant, and how much had been sort of interfered with by later developments and that cut through the site?
It actually survives reasonably well. When we think about the remains at the Rose, they were, you know, demolished to ground level. The theatre was definitely demolished to ground level. That kind of corroborates its dismantling. They did a very good job. So the curtain has a different end of life. Hmm. It doesn't have that dramatic end like those buildings do. So it closed in around 1627 and then it gets repurposed and slowly repurposed. So initially the side stage rooms are used for something. Possibly storage. And then there's a sort of a redevelopment that goes on in the mid 17th century, where they start building across it, over it, incorporating the stage. The timber superstructure comes down at that point because the foundations for the stage are masonry, they're brickwork. Mm. So that brickwork then becomes part of a row of tenements. And then when those tenements go out of use, it sort of 1680-ish, the next phase of development involves a whole load of material being brought onto the site and dumped on the site, and those remains get covered up quite quickly. So it's the way it falls into disuse rather than abruptly ending has actually preserved the remains as well as they have. So we have, I guess, about three quarters of it. About a quarter of it sits under the Horse and Groom pub on Curtain Road still. And from the depth of their cellars, it probably does exist under there to some extent. So, but we've got the business end. You know, we've got the stage, we've got those side stage rooms. We can see what was happening. We know we've got, you know, a building that's 22 metres across, probably somewhere between 25, 27 metres front to back. It's built off the back of an existing structure, possibly Curtain House, fronting Curtain Road. We have wall-to-wall standing at ground level. So we've got a gravel surface, goes all the way up to the, you know, say, wall-to-wall. We've got a big expanse of external gravel, possibly even the same size, again, as the playhouse. So that's kind of like the foyer. I always think of it, you know, it's a place to meet, mingle and drink. So we understand the outside space, we understand the inside space. Of all the buildings, we probably have a more complete story archaeologically.
And it's also, it's one of the longest running theatres as well, in the sense that, you know, the theatre, which is built about the same time, it gets dismantled and elements get reused for the Globe. The Swan doesn't has a slightly odd sort of theatrical usage history. And the Rose does reasonably well, but it's a sense that theatre buildings do not always last as long as you'd think. And the Curtain does have a very, very long life as an active theatre.
It carries on. It might be not, you know, it might not be the newest, most glamorous venue in town, but it's obviously good at doing what it's doing because it carries on. So yes, it's absolutely up and running by 1577. May even predate the theatre by a little bit. Archaeology can, you know, it would support that. But it can't prove it either, which is very annoying. But yeah, so it may actually predate the theatre by a year or so.
Yes, because it's one of those things. The theatre has that very definite 1576, and the Curtain, we know it exists by 1577.
Yes.
But we don't actually know when it really comes into being.
No, and I'm certainly not, this is what I keep saying, I'm certainly not going to date an entire building on one coin. But we did find a coin dated 1572 within the makeup deposits for the yard. It would have been handy if I found a few more, you know. having one. So yeah, I was thinking, well, yeah, there's and everything else. We could push it back to maybe 1575. It might be actually contemporary with Newington Butts, another rectangular venue. They might actually be sort of almost like twins at that point. You know, is it the reason Burbage and Co. build the theatre where they do? Are they cashing in on a venue that already exists?
Let's talk about Newington Butts. We have talked on the podcast with Laurie Johnson about Newington Butts, which was most enjoyable. Specifically about one temporal unit of it. Do we think we're going to get any additional archaeological evidence from Newington Butts?
No, we don't. I've looked. I've tried. You can't win them all. Unfortunately, that site was completely totaled by the planners in the 1960s that allowed the building of basemented Elephant and Castle Shopping Centre. So we have looked, we have tried, but unfortunately it didn't survive. And I think the same thing's happened to the Swan as well. The Swan, I think, is, you know, was taken out by a sort of triple basement in about 1972. But that can't happen now, and that's because of the Rose. So the huge uproar of the imminent destruction of the Rose back in the 80s actually brought archaeology into the planning process for the first time. It was instrumental into the introduction of a bit of legislation called PPG 16 in November 1990, which brought archaeology into the planning process for the first time. So the Curtain, the theatre, the Boar's Head, they all owe the Rose a debt for that.
So we've been doing this sort of chronologically backwards, or almost in terms of our
discussion. We started with the Hope, and we're now talking.
Yeah, we started with one of the later playhouses. We've sort of worked back from the Globe, the Rose.
Yeah, we're flicking around there, aren't we?
You know, we started with round structures, and we've gone back to square structures, Curtain, Newington Butts from the 1570s, and you've just brought up the Boar's Head, which is an inn playing space. Is that, or would you describe it as that? How would you describe it?
it's suffered a lot from it's not proper.
Mm.
It's not a proper playhouse. One, because it's a converted inn, and two, didn't play there. If we look at actually what happens, and archaeology has actually kind of confirmed what actually happens, is the inn carries on being an inn, and the yard is then the space in which a playhouse is constructed. And the archaeology seems to suggest that they actually operated as two independent businesses. So, my God, yeah, the Boar's Head, absolutely named after the inn it sits behind, absolutely is a proper playhouse.
Yes, I spoke to Provoke because we are of the same mind.
It's an easy misconception, though. You know, it's the Boar's Head, it's only a, you know, it's like, well, actually, we need to rethink what we mean by playhouse. We need to rethink what we mean by playing space. And actually me damning all the inns, you know, the city inns, they're absolutely playing spaces. Anyway, you know, regardless of whether they have something, somebody's gone out of their way to build a stage, a tiring house and some galleries.
Yes, because, I mean, I work in, you know, the modern theatre, and the modern theatre is full of found playing spaces or spaces that have been adapted to be a theatre in either a semi occasional fashion or in a permanent fashion. It's always seemed a bit silly to me to not talk about different playing spaces as being, you know, places of where theatre occurs. Theatre is something that happens if you have an audience and a performer. Tell me about the Boar's Head Theatre as a space. How does it function? How big is it? Is actually in when does it appear?
Actually,
as well?
You know what? Actually, Herbert Berry, bless him, wrote a brilliant book called The Boar's Head, in which are some fantastic drawings and some fantastic dimensions and measurements. And he's absolutely right. And she's no longer with us. I just wish I could have said to you, you're right. It's similar size capacity, I guess, to the theatre. It's not as big as the curtain. It's got, you know, sort of 12-foot stage rather than the 12-metre stage rather than the 14-metre stage. But, yeah, it's doing the same thing. We've got a stage. Okay, it's got its tiring house at the back, so it's got space. Surrounded on three sides by galleries, wall-to-wall standing on the ground floor. It's doing all the things that the curtain's doing.
What's its timetable? When does it appear? When does it disappear?
Well, it appears immediately, sort of 1598. Mm. So you think it's quite interesting because that's about the time the theatre disappears. So the theatre goes at about the same time the Boar's Head arrives. So it arrives 1598. Starts off as a stage in the middle of the yard. It's obviously a success because a year later, 1599, they go, you don't know what we're going to make this better. And they do. They upgrade it. So move the stage back, fix it, you know, fix a tiring house around it. And it goes on all the way through until the lease expires in 1616. So again, I guess not a very long life, really, but for playhouses of this period, that's actually doing quite well.
Yeah, I think a 20-year period seems to be about average, isn't it?
It's only the weird ones, the curtain, that's sort of 50 years.
Hmm. So what do we know outside of your actual excavating experience, but what do we know about the various inns that are existing around London, prior to this as well? Because we've mostly been situating in the sort of 1570s onwards. What do we have about the earlier stuff?
We do have that reference to, I was going to say performance, but it's actually non-performance, September 1557 at the Boar's Head Inn. They try and put on and play A Sack Full of News, which is then deemed to be lewd. Who doesn't love a lewd play? And the actors run into trouble, and it is not seen, it is not performed, and they're hauled off. So we have that, you know, whether there's playing in between then 1557 up to the 1590s, who knows, but it would seem odd if there wasn't. So, yeah, I'm always intrigued by who the audience is in an inn. I'm kind of, you know, it's almost like if you come into town, you've done business, it's too late in the day to travel home. Hey, might as well, you know, what am I doing this afternoon? I'm kicking around town. I made some money. What do? Hey, I can take in a show. And I'm, you know, our inn's actually just natural spaces for people with not much to do in the afternoon to hang out. So I'm kind of, I've kind of been thinking about who actually is the audience.
Is it like Vegas? You go to the casino and you end up catching a show, but that's not really why you're there.
Sure. Most Londoners actually have a job to do in the afternoon. So who is it, these people? That obviously, you know, there's obviously a lot of them for this many venues to exist. Who is it that's actually hanging around a loose end for 4 hours on the afternoon?
And do we get an idea of what the kind of dimensions for some of these spaces might be as opposed to the other more established spaces? Do we think they're dimensionally substantially smaller, or are they, you know, do they function in a sort of a modern analogy? Are they more like a fringe venue, or are they actually substantial spaces?
I think they're substantial spaces. I mean, they're obviously, I think, they're limited maybe to how much you can invest in your special effects, for instance, how much you can invest into scenery, because you've got to take it there.
Yeah, there's no on-site storage.
Well, we don't know. There might be, but yeah, you haven't got, you know, the shed out the back that's yours necessarily. So how much does that alter what's being put on? I don't know. It's quite an interesting one, but again, they fit the spaces available. Whereas the curtain, they're in the middle of a field. They can build it any size they like. They build it that size.
Because is there a sort of atmospheric difference between that kind of venue? Is it doing something structurally different, which, you know, changes the way the audience interacts, the way the stage effects are, and also, you know, how often are they performing? What is their repertoire? And are other things happening instead? I mean, that's the other multi-purpose nature of spaces. Well,
I was thinking about the Belle Savage and fencing, and we know there's that, you know, it's like, you know, if you fence at the Belle Savage, because the stage is high, it's 6 foot stage, it's got no edges to it, you know, there's that thing about, you know, if you fall off the stage, you're going to break your neck. Whereas at the curtain, we know there's fencing displays being put on at the curtain. Because of the fabric of the building, you've got end stops, if you like, on the stage, because you've got those side stage rooms. If you go back, you come up against the wall, you don't fall off. So was it actually built primarily for fencing displays rather than drama? Possibly. You know, is that why I would say, you know, do we have fightier plays in the kind of rectangular venues rather than a bit of rom-com, you know, do we have a bit more Tarantino going on up, or, you know, maybe we do. So yeah, there's other things. We really have to rethink what we mean by play that happens in a playhouse. It just basically means leisure, doesn't it? It means how much, you know, I'm being entered, you know, I'm at leisure, I'm not at work. So all sorts of things can fall into that.
And of course, you know, it's not just that we have potentially multi-purpose venues. In a sense, you have multi-purpose playing companies as well, in the sense that they're not idiots. They know if they're playing to a different size space, they're going to be performing a different play, or they may be doing things, or they may not have the option of scenery or specific things in certain spaces. So again, it changes what the repertoire is. It may not change what their repertoire is, but it may change how their repertoire functions.
I can see what you're saying.
Because modern actors know perfectly well, you go into a small space, you bring it down, you go into a big space, it gets loud, you know, and it changes the shape of the show. And what's the difference between playing in an inn, or at a round place, or a square space, or on tour in other found spaces that are much less permanent. Does permanence matter to a space?
Well, indeed. I suppose the difference, I always think of the difference between playing in an inn and playing at the Boar's Head Playhouse, for instance, is the fact you actually have to pay to go into that space. Whereas an inn, you can just kind of wander through. You can wander through to your room. You can wander through to the bar. You can wander. You're not kind of paying. You're not committing to being there necessarily, maybe. I don't know. This is why I'm kind of interested in how the finance works. How, you know, we understand how it works at a playhouse because we have the gatherers at the door. We know that. Fine. How does it work in an inn? You know, is it passing the hat round, or is it somehow kind of roped off? You know, I don't know. You can't come over here. We're, you know, we're putting on performance. You have to pay to go over to that bit of the yard. I really don't know.
I would have thought if it was if it functioned that way, we would have heard about more fights.
I think so.
You know, we have enough because you know we have that, that story of the when the Queen's men are on tour and there is an unfortunate murder due to someone not paying to get into the, into a space. So I, you know, when it's not potentially not as well organised because of the nature of the space doesn't allow you to do it. And you know, is it the inns paying them on some fee principle, and that it's just it's a bonus for their patrons, or and then they pass a hat round to fill in the gaps?
Yeah, is it they get more trade at the bar because they've got entertainment? You know, it's like having the you know TV on showing the sport, isn't it, in the pub? Yeah, I'm quite intrigued how they actually financially work. Something I don't think archaeology can.
No, I
mean that, but that's you know.
But yeah, so it's that, that intersection between you know the various data points we've got. I mean, we were sort of talking about this this matrix of evidence that you know you're talking about a signature of what does a playhouse look archaeologically, but you know also what does it look like by the activity that's in it, any space having that kind of signature. So prior to 1576, everything's square. And everything's square because that's a really easy way to build a structure.
If I was going to build a house, I would build a square one.
Yeah, it, all your furniture fits. It's so much easier.
You've got edges.
Yeah,
that fit things. Absolutely.
Is there a reason why, or do we think there's a reason why suddenly we have this spate of round buildings?
Okay. The lunacy of Burbage is like, you know, what was he thinking? Okay, so if we have the known playing spaces, and I'm always kind of, you know, just because they're the ones we know about doesn't mean there's some, you know, some outliers there that are missing from our radar, but the known at that point. So we've got the Red Lion down at, you know, Stepney, what, 1567-ish? We've got Newington Butts, we've got the Curtain, sort of 1570s, and those three are named after place. Newington Butts, it's called just the Playhouse, I think. You've got Red Lion is named after farm it's built in, and the Curtain is obviously named after Curtain Close, the space it's built in. They have Burbage coming along going, I'm going to build this mad 14-sided, three-story high structure. And I'm going to call it the theatre. Is he, at this point, attempting to build essentially the Colosseum? Because he's not naming it after place. He's actually naming it after what it is and what it does. And when you look at, there's several kind of engravings, woodcuts, whatever, of the Colosseum, and at that point it's called the Theatre of Rome. So is it kind of that idea that theatre is a space for combat, it's got that kind of violence, it's got that gladiatorial nature to it? Is that what he's actually trying to do? So he's cashing in going, right, I'm going to build this basic gladiator arena in Shoreditch and I'm going to call it the theatre. And then you've got quite a while, I guess, till the Rose is built, 1587?
Yes, that's the.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, do I get.
Yeah, that's the one I've got written down on the bit of paper in front of me, yes.
Yeah, okay. So we got quite a gap before they, you know. So, okay, we've got the Rose, which is seems to be an exact copy, dimensionally anyway, of the theatre. 14-sided, 22 metres across, three stories high. The round one we're talking about. So why. And this is the other thing. Why do they then change it into a more horseshoe, more square shape at the playing end? If these are so good at what they do, if these are such good spaces, these polygonal spaces, because we have the Swan by then, don't we, 1595? So we've got the swan then. It's about the same time the rose changes shape. Why are they making it squarer at the business end? This intrigues me. I think we need to re-look at the archaeological archive in its totality from the rose. With this kind of, what are they doing? Why are they doing that? Because it's an investment. It's not actually getting many more people in, really. Or you're actually just altering the stage shape, primarily. You're not kind of adding, you know, volume in terms of audience capacity. And then obviously you get the globe, the round one, right?
Well, to be fair, you had a big round one, which was the theatre, so you're not necessarily increasing the number of round theatres.
We swap one for the other, but it's substantially rounder. No, it's substantially bigger. It's 16, between 16 and 18 sides, say. And has a bigger capacity, is a bigger building. So why then, if these are the way forward, these big round things are the way forward, do they build the fortune in the same year as a square structure? Just up the road from the curtain, it's now rivaling the curtain because it's the glitzy new square venue north of the city. If it's quite interesting, if you look at them chronologically, I know we've been bouncing around all over the place chronologically, but if you look at them chronologically, it's not one shape replaces another. Both are valid forms all the way through that period. And what does happen is if you look at them spatially. So if we were looking at a map of London in 1600, you would have north of the city, the fortune, the curtain, and the boar's head, rectangular or square structures. On Bankside, we would have what? The swan, the hope, the swan, the rose, and the globe. Three round venues on Bankside, three square venues north. So, yeah, it's, what are they doing? What are they doing? Is it we have the more fighty stuff going on in those squarer venues? A bit more rom-com down on Bankside. I don't know. There's something there. And I think we could debate this for a long time.
And it's interesting because, in a sense, we don't necessarily the number of playhouses active seem to remain relatively stable throughout as well. It's not like that. There's an exponential number of theatres all in competition. There is a relatively finite number.
I think if you look at it's kind of misleading if you look at a map of all the venues in London, inns, indoor playing spaces. If it looks swamped, that map looks absolutely swamped. But say, if you look at it, say 1600, three up north, three down south.
Yeah,
that seems, you know. But I mean, I'm excluding the inns.
Well, that's why I was asking about capacity, you see. I was wondering whether, in the same way, we haven't talked about either of the Blackfriars spaces or anything like that. Or for that matter, any of the spaces used by other spaces used by boys' companies and things like that. So where, again, capacity might be less, and therefore the question of how many you have is less important, if that makes sense. Because there has to be a finite limit. Well, of course, we talk about theatres as being full, but of course then they're not full very often necessarily. I mean, we don't have a huge amount of data.
I mean, how many times do they play to, you know, two guys and their dog? You know, I mean, obviously, because I have the plans, I can understand the area that's available for the audience to occupy in these buildings. I haven't yet worked it out for the boar's head. Okay, so yeah, I've got to go and do that. But if we look at, a kind of audience density, if you like, of three people per square metre. You think about that, that's quite an uncomfortable lift. You know, if you get into a lift and it's a little bit too squishy in there, that's probably about three people per square metre. It's just that really quite tight and not very pleasant. If we go for that kind of density at the theatre, it has a capacity of around 880 people. Okay, so these aren't exact numbers, it's kind of just a ratio that I've kind of, working out with this building. The curtain is about 1400. And the first globe, that, yes, bigger than the theatre, because the theatre is quite tiny, probably about 2200. So adding a couple of extra sides and making that a little bit bigger actually has a massive impact on the amount of audience capacity for that particular building. So yeah, are they full every production? Absolutely not.
It's a shame because we only have Henslowe's Diary accounts that give us a reasonably good idea, but even there we have to make some sort of
suppositions going into that.
With them, but that only really gives us a couple of theatres throughout it the coverage of the diary. And it's quite frustrating because, as I say, we're always talking about you could cram them in because you don't have health and safety in the same way. I'm just going there, but how often do you need to? I mean, it's because the big draw seems to be, you know, the first night or afternoon of a new play, or certainly that seems to become a draw. You can charge more money and there's more of a impetus to see the new thing. But, you know, when it's a play that has been around the houses about, you know, five times, it's a wet Thursday afternoon. How many people turn up?
Well, this is quite interesting when we look at the curtain, because I said we've got that outside space, we've got that big outside gravel space for milling around on, drinking beer, meeting with your friends, gambling, doing whatever you're doing out there. I'm kind of thinking these buildings are more than just a playhouse. You should think about them as playhouse complexes. But those outside spaces are just a much of that play-going experience as actually standing in front of the stages. So you're at the playhouse for 4 hours, not necessarily actually standing in front of the place watching what's going on. It's the same way if you go to the cinema. If you're at the cinema tonight and I phoned you, said, where are you? And you say, I'm at the cinema. You could be standing in the foyer while you take that call. You'd still say, I'm at the cinema. Doesn't actually mean you're sitting in your seat getting bad looks because you've just taken a phone call. It means that outside space is just as much part of the playgoing experience as being inside that structure. We know we've got outside space at the theatre. We know we've got this outside space at the Boar's Head, and we certainly do at the curtain. So I'm kind of wondering how much movement there is between inside, outside. You know, do you just run in for the bit you like? Do you just run in for the fight scene? Oh, this is the good bit. This is where he gets murdered. Quick, we're going to watch that bit. Oh, this is the boring bit now. He's just kind of waffling on. We're going back and finish our drink. And you actually move. It possibly has a much more fluid dynamic than, say, happens at the Globe, where you may be more contained within that space.
Yes, because there are spaces, because there's always that exaggerated idea that, you know, the city fathers and various institutions were not keen on theatres and players and all the rest of it. But sometimes you do get quite legitimate complaints where if a site is quite narrow or awkward, or and you've got an awful lot of people coming in and out, where it's not really NIMBYism, actually.
I want to get much to my front door, and I spend time to cram my way through all these people every time I want to go to my front door.
I wonder also whether over time you get new residents moving in and then complaining that they've moved in next door to a theatre, you know, the way that nightclubs have.
I've moved into a pub and they're really loud. Well, exactly that, yes. Because you've got so much churn in London. Constant, you know, if you look at the death rate and look at it's not a healthy place to live.
No, its population only remains stable or increases because people keep dying.
Population and people keep moving in. Rockets, you know, during the 16th century. So there must be so many people coming in, constant churn of folk coming in. And you say moving into maybe the not as nicer neighbourhoods, maybe. And then you say complaining about the neighbours.
Is there gentrification from these slightly outside the city wall theatres? Are they sending the players in to bring up the quality of the neighbourhood?
I don't think it works that way. No, I think quite the reverse. I think quite the reverse. If you think of all these, how should I say, allied trades that are attached to these buildings. I don't think you'd. It's not maybe a prime address, no.
I mean, because the swan is probably all gone archaeologically. How confident are we on what shape it is?
Well, we do have the drawing by DeWitt. You know, we, even though it's a copy of a copy of the drawing, I think, but we do have a copy. You know, of it's the only image I think really we have. The inside of the playhouse is the swan, and that does seem to show a polygonal structure. Mm. I'm okay with that. I think, you know, they're not easy things to draw, are they, circles? And if it was square, it'd be much, much easier. Mm. And there's a flag on the top of it which has a picture of a swan on it, so we're pretty confident it is the swan. So I'm what a shame we didn't have that one there. You know, what a shame that one in the 70s. It only hung on for a couple of decades.
I think we've got a real sense of that theatre world as it develops. Of course, it all sort of comes tumbling down in the 1640s, 1642, when the playhouses are all shut as the Civil War Part One gets going, and buildings get abandoned, demolished, occasionally still used, actually, quite a lot. Any thoughts on sort of the end of the theatres from that period?
Not really, but I think it's quite interesting that if we thought restoration, they come back square and rectangular. They don't come back, hey, let's build one of those big fancy round things, which I always think is kind of, you know, if they were that good, why didn't you? It's like, no, we're not trying that again. That was a good experiment. But it's run its course. We'll go, you know, we'll build something that's easy, reliable, comfortable, flexible space. And
it's another one of those examples where people don't necessarily talk about proper theatres in this in the same way, because, you know, those initial theatres, you know, the first few years, they are using found spaces. They adapt space. Nobody says they're not theatres. You know, a few years later, they do build some you know, from scratch. But the beginning of Restoration Theatre is very ad hoc. There's an awful lot of scrambling around and pulling stuff together. And so nobody does what happens in the 16th, 17th century of just going, yeah, it's not a real theatre.
No.
used to be, you know, back of an inn. Can't be real.
It can't be real. It's not proper. Mm. Not purpose built.
Mm.
Which is a very odd phrase. Purpose built. It's built with a purpose. You don't get, even a folly is built with a purpose, and that's the purpose is to be a folly. So, you know,
it's like, you know, the is the Donmar warehouse in London a theatre?
Yes.
Yes. Doesn't matter that it used to be a warehouse before that. It doesn't matter.
It is a theatre.
It's a theatre. I think we've covered all everything. Anything you'd like to throw in before we close the session?
Only that we've now got to, I think, a point where in London, anyway, we are probably not going to dig another theatre site, another playhouse site. We've got all the data that we're going to get.
Mm.
So this is actually quite a useful time to actually think back over, you know, over the last, what, 35 years, I guess, and just kind of think about the things that we've learned, like the big headline takeaways from what we've learned from the last 35 years. I think the big one is we have to be a lot less centric in our thinking. I think we have to be a lot less London-centric in our thinking. We have to think, you know, playhouses exist in other parts of the country. Certainly, you know, I was thinking Bristol particularly, you know, comes to mind. And actually, we have to be a lot less England-centric in our thinking. You know, those connections with, say, Gdansk or Almagro, you know, they're such similar buildings. existing at the same kind of time, doing the same kind of thing. And proper, essentially, proper doesn't have to be round. And the curtain carries on being the game changer.
Well, especially, yes, if we're thinking about theatres across the country, of course, they're all not going to be round as well. You're going to spend most of your time playing in a square building.
Yeah, and I think the curtain, Holger was absolutely right when he described it. Holger Simon was absolutely right when he described it as a game-changing moment, because it absolutely was. It's because it's actually freed us to think about other spaces as playhouses, as theatres, as on an equal standing and equal footing.
And on that note, I think is an excellent place to end. Thank you so much for joining me on this this discussing
thank
episode.
You.
Thank you very much to Heather Knight. And that's it for us on playhouses and other spaces. Till next time, goodbye. I'm now reaching that sort of point where I'm sort of going, have I got an actual new point, or am I just saying words?